Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to another amazing, incredible, informative episode of The Partial Historians. I am one of your amazing hosts, Dr. Peter Greenfield.
And I am Dr. Radness, slightly sweating at the build-up that you just gave this episode.
Is it exciting?
Oh, it's going to be exciting. Because once again, we are dealing with a semi-mythical king of Rome.
I kind of love this.
Yes. Well, I suppose we haven't really been giving you many dates, which isn't very helpful. So perhaps we should start off with some dates.
Oh, yeah. I apologize. I'm usually up on that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm not.
But yeah. In our last episode, we looked at Tullus Hostilius.
Yes.
And
he reigned, we think, according to the tradition.
According to the chronology that the Romans have imposed upon themselves.
Yeah. We think about 32 years, which would make his reign from about 672 to about 640. BC.
Yeah.
So basically, we've had Romulus, who ruled from 753 to 716. Then we had Numa, who was 715 to 672. Tullus, and now we're up to
Ancus Marcius.
Oh my god, I'm such an idiot. Not the third king of Rome. The fourth king of Rome. I can't even count. Oh my god, what's wrong with
this? This is why you do history. Yeah. Not mathematics. That's fine. You know, totally passed me by. Yeah. But date-wise, so Ancus comes in 640,
yes,
and rules down to approximately 616.
Yeah, so he has actually kind of a shorter rule, when you think about it.
Relatively.
Yeah, but still quite a long time, given the time that they're living in when people can drop dead very quickly.
And wait, consider the smoothness of his entrance.
Oh, I know. Be still. Be still in my beating heart. Because I would just like to insert a quote here, if I may, as I tend to do at random times. Random quote coming.
I await your insertion.
Yeah, because I suppose Ancus's rule is one of the briefest account-wise. You know, like, there's not a whole lot of material that we have here.
No, as will become clear as we start to go through
exactly.
it.
Yeah, exactly. So I would like to say at the outset, quoting Gary Forsyth, that the ancient literary tradition concerning the early kings can perhaps best be likened to a contemporary Hollywood blockbuster concerning some major historical episode. Though the movie is beautifully produced and tells the story in a powerful and memorable fashion, the viewer is left wondering what parts of the film are historically accurate and what parts are distortions or outright fabrications introduced into the plot to make the movie more appealing.
I think this is a highly appropriate quote for where we're
now. For once, I got it right.
You always get it right, Dr. Radness. There are various things that are considered to be insertions into the rule of Ancus Marcius, which, even amongst our ancient source material, are disputed and attributed to other mythical kings.
Yeah.
And I'm going to include some of that material here, because, frankly, we don't have a lot.
Well, no, what else are we going to do?
Yeah. So I'm happy enough to take certain historical assertions over others for the sake of the space. So, but whether some of these things, and I'm talking here particularly about the rituals of the Fetiales.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
yes.
I'll come up to those later. There is discrepancy about who they could be connected with.
Sure.
Even amongst the ancient sources who deal with this.
Yeah.
And nobody seems to be quite sure. And since we're dealing with this sort of semi-mythical period anyway, we're really dealing.
What the hell?
Yeah. Just throw all the cornflakes to the wind and see how they fall.
Exactly. So we dealt last time with Tullus, who dies apparently of some sort of pestilence-related disease, perhaps.
Or a lightning bolt. Or being murdered.
Yeah. Either way, he's dead. And once again, we return to the interregnum.
Yes. So the Senate says, you, sir, can be the interrex.
Yes. Now, Ancus Marcius, or Marcus, depending on what source you're looking at, apparently is a descendant of Numa, the second king of Rome.
Yes.
By his mother.
Mm.
Yes.
So this would make him a Sabine of sorts.
Exactly. And it would also mean that, not that there's like a hereditary thing, but keeping it in the family,
Yeah. That's a slight nod to a dynastic rule, I suppose.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, the Comitia get together and they elect Ancus, and everybody seems pleased with that.
And we should probably point out, I suppose, what the Comitia actually is.
What it was involving
at this point in time. It's basically, it seems to be this process where basically the people vote first, it would seem, and then the fathers kind of like, I guess, the upper classes, as you will. The Senate. Yeah. They then sort of say, yes, rubber you prove stamp your it. Choice. Exactly. That seems to be the system that we have going.
Everybody gets together. The organisation of the committee at this point in time is up for grabs.
Yeah. Who knows? We don't really know a lot about it.
As is the composition of the Senate to a large degree.
Yeah.
But the idea is that the Senate sort of comes later on after the people have made a decision and they're either like, yes, we agree, that was a good choice, or they're like, I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm feeling suspicious.
Yeah.
And their view tends to count or not count depending on what's going on.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So he gets elected and he is quite family minded. He's very family-minded when it comes to Numeru in particular.
Yeah, he feels really strongly that religious observances have been neglected.
Yeah, particularly under Tullus.
Yes. And
couldn't really say that about Numa, so I don't know why I'm saying particularly under Tullus.
He sort of wants to hark back a bit of a nod to Numa at this point in time and focus on ritual. Get rid of the neglect, get rid of the misconduct.
Yeah.
One of the things he does, which is really important in terms of religious observance in Rome, seems to be this idea of making all of the state sacrifices and the attendant rituals associated with them available to the public.
Mm.
So he talks to the pontifex and he's like,
knowledge is power.
Yeah, you need to write this stuff down on some really cool tablets and stick it in a public area. White tablets. Only the white ones.
Yeah.
Yes. So there is this moment of sort of public knowledge, if you like, of what is ritual, what is required, when it's required.
Yep.
And so this is a transition, if you like, out of sort of the esoteric secretness of Roman religion.
Yep.
And making it much more transparent. So the idea that neglect and misconduct will be lowered as a result of this. Yeah, because
everyone apparently was keeping their eye on this.
Yeah.
And apparently the citizens who had become somewhat sick of perhaps the war under Tullus, as well as people around Rome who might have been getting sick of being poked with a long wooden stick.
Stop, guys.
They're all very pleased by this turn of events because they think he's going to be like Numa and very diplomatic and very peaceful.
Yeah, this seems to yield a sense in the areas around Rome that perhaps he's not going to be a warlike leader.
Sure.
And this gets some people excited about the possibility that now's the time to attack Rome.
Oh, God. Will they never learn?
This is going to be great. This is our opportunity.
Yeah. So basically, the Latins apparently say, hey, let's maybe break this treaty we have with the previous king and start raiding.
I've got an idea. How about some raids into Roman land?
Yeah, and Ancus tries to be quite diplomatic and, you know, sort of say, what's going on there? I don't approve of this. And they feel very bold and apparently are quite arrogant when they send back their replies. I'm guessing they say things like, what are you going to do about it, old man?
Probably. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. But Ancus. Ooh, that Ancus.
Ancus is pretty keen to have some established religious observances in place around the process of war.
Yeah.
So he sees...
And he's also not... And this is the thing. He's also not anti-war as much as they might think.
No.
No.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no. As they're about to find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's in this position where he's like, oh, well, people are attacking us. We should probably have something to, like, when we've been attacked, like, to take revenge.
Ooh.
And revenge. We should probably get that sanctioned by the gods.
That would be good,
wouldn't it? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I like it.
And so he has this sort of moment where he delves into the rituals of the priesthood of the Fediales.
Oh, you just go right ahead because I don't know what you're talking about.
Well.
Enlighten me.
The Fediales are either, according to Livy, and Livy himself seems to contradict himself on this point as well.
Sure.
Are either created by Ancus as a priesthood to deal with these specific sort of issues.
Yeah.
Or they were created by Numa.
Okay, yeah. I can see how you could get confused there.
Yeah.
Because they have that connection between them.
The Fediales are a priesthood that are connected by Dionysius of Halicarnassus and Plutarch to Numa.
Right.
And Livy himself, early on in Book 1, Section 24, if you're interested, addresses the Fediales as if they're associated with Tullus.
Yep.
And yet here we are, in Livy.
And he's once again attributing them to someone else.
Yes, yes. So make of this what you will. The Hollywood blockbuster element of ancient kings definitely comes into play.
Does it come here? Does it come there? Who cares? Well, let's just put it in for interest's sake.
The ritual itself is really interesting, and regardless of who comes up with it, it's fascinating because it's complicated and dangerous for the people involved.
I like it. I like the sound of it.
First of all, once you get into a situation where somebody's attacked you and you're like, I probably need some revenge.
Fair enough.
What you do is you send one of these guys out, one of these fediales. The envoy goes and, first of all, he goes to the frontier, the borderlands between Roman territory and the territory of the enemy. And recites a whole bunch of things with Jupiter as his witness, going, these are the things that have gone wrong. These are the things that need to be redressed. I'm putting it out there. He's Jupiter as my witness. And then he starts to walk into the enemy territory.
Yes. Actually, I do know what you're talking about.
The first man that he meets in enemy territory, he's like, these are the things that we need to address. I need
you
vengeance.
You keep leaving the toilet seat up, and I'm not happy about it.
Jupiter as my witness.
Yeah, exactly.
We're offended. So he does the same ceremonial calling out to the gods and demand for retribution to the first person he meets.
Yep.
Then he enters the city gates, stops there, stops at the city gates.
Now
he's
we're
like,
getting dangerous. Yeah.
How about some of this? This stuff has gone down.
Yeah.
Jupiter's not very happy, guys.
You keep leaving off milk in the fridge, and it really ticks me off.
I need vengeance.
Yep.
He walks into the city. He goes to the forum.
Yep.
Heads to the marketplace, goes where all the people are at, and he does the same thing again. Jupiter as my witness, we need some retribution. I don't know why you'd let this guy live.
Yeah.
Like, why would you just let him wander into your territory?
What would happen if he got killed by someone?
I don't know.
It would
be crazy.
Yeah.
But anyhow, he gets in, he stays in the city then.
Right.
He goes and meets with...
He'd be so welcome.
Yeah. Goes and meets with the officials.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, so guys, this is the deal. Jupiter as my witness.
Yeah.
And...
You've been overcharging us, and we're not happy about it.
Jupiter as my witness.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, I'll give you guys 10 days to think about this because, like, warfare, you know.
Yeah, it's on the horizon.
I'm just warning you
that
this has gone down and you guys need to be prepared. Do you want to, like, negotiate or anything? After 10 days, he goes back and meets with them, and he's like, have you come up with an answer yet? And they're like, and he's like, Jupiter as my witness. He's like, I'll give you another 10 days. That's the sort of guy I am. Goes away, gives them another 10 days. I don't know what he does in these 10 days while he's hanging out in the city.
He sees the sights, naturally.
Yeah, well, he's now been in the city for 20 days.
Yeah.
And he's like, wow, I'm hanging out here a lot. And he's like, I hope these guys don't kill me.
He's probably wandering around going, this is the best meal I've ever had. Jupiter's my witness.
He goes
seriously,
a third
give me the
time.
Recipe. Yeah.
Goes a third time.
Yep.
He's like, guys, seriously.
Yep.
Like, Jupiter as my witness, these things need to be solved.
What's going on?
Yeah. And when he doesn't get the answer or when he gets a answer, it doesn't really matter at this point in time.
Sure.
If he's done the ritual the three times to the people inside the city and has not been satisfied by their response, he shoots back to Rome and is like, guys, we've got issues.
Yes.
We need to do some war.
And they do.
Yeah. He goes and consults with the king and the Senate.
Yep.
And then if a war is agreed upon.
Sure.
Then that
then
guy
can happen.
Then the fediale sort of wanders back to the frontier and ceremoniously throws a spear into their territory.
That's the part I know.
And it's like, how about some of that?
Yeah.
And this is going down now.
Most notably, I think this has been appropriated in the 1963 Cleopatra, when Octavius gets all worked up over Antony shacking up with Cleopatra, and he wanders outside of the Senate House with a spear, and throws it at Cleopatra's visiting dignitary. Not quite the same thing, but I think the message is got across nonetheless.
Yeah.
Anywho,
yeah.
Back to the point ahead.
Yeah. So apparently this is, according to Livy, at some point in his narrative, but with question marks hanging over it.
I guess it kind of fits there, because with Ancus we apparently have someone who's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. He's religious, but also not a pushover.
Yeah, and narrative-wise, Livy has certainly set up his narrative so that it's a moment where the Romans are looking for revenge, where they've actually been the victim for a change.
Yes.
That hasn't happened for a little while.
No.
I know there's been a lot of battles, but Rome seems to be mostly the instigator.
Yeah.
So it suits nicely in Ancus's narrative
to
have this ritual in place.
It flows. Yeah. So they start fighting the Latins to get back to Ancus's.
Yeah, so the whole reason why they've done it.
So basically, they have this successful campaign against the Latins.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, they find themselves capturing a town. Yeah. And getting some spoils as a result.
As you do.
Tick, tick. Yes. Like it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they adopt the same principle that they used with the Alban conquest.
Yes.
So they take the population in hand.
Yep.
Take them to Rome. Yep. Make them citizens.
Yep.
They settle them on the Aventine.
Ooh, another hill.
Opening up another one of those
Aventine,
hills.
Aventine, Aventine. Anyway. And they have more territory, once again. Thumbs up. Yeah, exactly. So once again, we have this great growth in the populace. Yeah.
Yeah, because they take about three Latin cities in this way, which are sort of brushed over quite quickly in the narrative.
I'm getting a bit sick of narrating war, quite frankly.
Ooh. No. It's pretty important.
I jest.
So they take a city called Politorium,
mm-hmm.
The people of Telenae, and Ficana.
Ugh, why do the names have to be so complicated?
And all of these conquered peoples of these Latin territories get sent to the Aventine to live and be Roman citizens.
No, it doesn't really surprise you, therefore, to find out that with all these people flushing into Rome, that there is apparently a problem with lawlessness.
There seems to be a sense in which all of these new citizens don't really understand Roman customs and appropriate law.
It's very hard to say who's right and who's wrong.
Also, you've just thrown together a whole bunch of people of different backgrounds and different areas and just gone, how about it, guys? You're all friends and citizens now.
Yeah.
It takes a little while for these sorts of things to settle down.
Yeah. So they build a prison, apparently, to accommodate these bandits, damn.
Yeah, you know, it's a good idea.
In the middle of the city.
Yeah, it's at the foot of the Capitoline.
Yeah.
So just above the Forum. It's called the Carcer. Oh, you can see what's happening with Latin, guys.
Yeah.
And so they set up this prison. That's going to be great. There's a whole bunch of building works that Ancus ends up being associated with.
Yes, very important ones too.
Yeah, because he annexes one of the settlements on the other side of the Tiber.
Yeah.
Which
Janiculum. Is the river that goes through Rome.
Yep. Yes, the river that goes through Rome.
Yeah.
So he annexes one of these areas, the Janiculum.
Yes.
And then builds a bridge. The first bridge over the Tiber.
Well, see, if anyone who's actually been to Rome, the Tiber is well and truly in Rome, like now.
It is.
Yeah, so it's hard to imagine a time when it wasn't.
But it wasn't. It was like the edge of the city.
Yeah, exactly.
In this early phase.
Yeah, so this is cool.
So they build what is called the Pons Subilicius, the Pile Bridge.
Yum.
Delightful. Made solely of wood.
Not perhaps the most practical, but I understand why.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And in order to sort of protect the other side of the city, he also starts to build a ditch. called the Curtius Ditch, the Citizens Ditch, to protect the more level side of the city.
Fair enough.
You just never know where the enemy is going to come from.
You just don't, yeah. I was rather impressed to find out that apparently he also founds Ostia.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, he does.
Which I've also been to, and is also pretty cool.
So Ostia has a very long relationship with Rome.
Yeah.
And it's the port city on the mouth of the Tiber.
Yeah.
So you can
still go there and check out the ruins.
Very well
worthwhile.
There is a lot of archaeological work taking place at Ostia.
I actually think it's almost cooler than Pompeii.
Wow.
Yes. I'm just going to put that out there. But anyway.
I think, it's probably a lot more, it's a richer site.
Yes. I think so. I enjoyed my stay there.
Ostia, known for its ancient shopping. No, serious.
Yeah, no. No, I know.
So they extend their influence in various ways.
Yeah.
They actually take over a whole bunch of stuff towards... it's sort of Etruscan territory, which means that they've got, like, seaward access.
Yes.
And Ostia also features into that as well, obviously.
Yeah.
And... there's also a temple expansion.
Ooh. Oh, you would know about this, of course. Yeah.
The temple of Jupiter Feretrius is expanded during this period, as far as we can tell.
Well, it's important to back things up in the historical sources with archaeological confirmation that this stuff is actually happening.
Yeah. Well, part of the issue is that, like, the archaeological work for this sort of time period,
yeah,
does suggest that a lot of these buildings do match up sort of chronologically.
Yeah, with what we're being told.
With what we're being told.
It's hard,
but that doesn't mean that we can credit them to
these
kings that we have listed
exactly
in the narratives.
Like, we think this person was historical, but it could be more than one. Who knows? And also, it's harder, like, because obviously the earlier the time period you're talking about, the deeper you're digging, generally speaking.
What?
And it's hard when you've got, like, a city that's still existing on top of that to boot. So, yes, it can be quite tricky with these early periods to use archaeology to confirm historical stuff.
Yes, for sure. And perhaps Ostia might be a more fruitful excavation in that sense.
Exactly.
Given
no one's still living there.
Yes.
Not really, anyway.
So Ancus sort of has this combination, as it turns out, of being relatively religiously focused, warlike when he needs to be, and also a builder.
Yeah, so he's very balanced.
And perhaps this is why his narrative is so short in the sources, because he's just doing everything right.
Not very scandalous.
No.
Except, I suppose we have to flag at this point in time, because it's during his reign, obviously, that we have the ascension of the Darquin family.
Oh, yeah.
Will become rather important later on.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is sort of a narrative sort of tangent that Livy takes as well to introduce us to
the next big family.
Yeah, the Tarquinii. And the reason for doing that in Ancus's reign is because of the intimate relationship that develops between Ancus and Tarquinius.
Yeah, because basically, as we've pointed out in a previous episode, although we are in a period of monarchy, we're not dealing with a period where you're just having a king succeeded by his son and so forth and so on. It's pretty clear that it's kind of actually an election process.
It is.
And basically, the Tarquin family are kind of outsiders. I mean, not that, you know, obviously we've had, you know, plenty of kings who aren't Roman, and I'm using the flesh rabbits.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I'm serious. But yeah, basically they move to Rome.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because they feel like their ambitions might be more satisfied in
this
area.
Yeah, let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
Once upon a time.
Yeah. In a village not that far away.
There was a young man called Lucumo.
Oh, I like that name.
Yes. He was the son of a gentleman, Demaritus of Corinth.
Apparently. Yes.
And a native woman of the Tarquinii, which is an Etruscan family.
Yeah.
Just to point that out.
Yeah. And she was quite up there.
No.
What?
No. Don't go there.
What are you talking about?
She's going to become his wife. She can't be the mother as well, can she?
Oh, sorry. I thought we were up to the marriage.
No. No.
I've lost track.
He's a baby. I just started the story.
I'm sorry. I'm jumping ahead. Continue. Okay. So he was born.
He was born.
Yeah.
His father.
It's like David Copperfield. I was born.
Yes. I'm a special family.
Exactly, yeah.
So his father is an outsider and presumably Greek. Unlucky.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just makes him more of an outsider at this point in time.
Sure, yeah, fair enough.
And a native woman of the Tarquinii.
Yeah.
So an Etruscan family.
Yes.
So he's considered a bit of an outsider, and he never really gets, like, you know, the leg up in society.
He wants to.
Etruscans are very traditional, it would seem, and are like, no, actually, you're not really one of us.
Because his father had apparently, and again, using flesh rabbits around all of this stuff, jumping all over the place, his father has apparently sort of driven out of his native Greek town. Is it Corinth?
Yeah.
So driven out. So, yeah, the Etruscans are like, wow, you're like the son of someone who's a stranger to us and also someone who's banished from their previous town.
Like, who are
That's
you?
That's unlucky.
Yeah. I don't think you're one of us.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Lucumo grows up with this sense in which he feels, like, stymied in his ambitions.
Yes.
And he's like...
frustrated.
Yeah. You know, like, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Fortunately, he actually ends up being quite rich.
That is fortunate.
Yeah. So when he has a brother called Aruns.
Yes.
And Aruns dies and leaves a son.
Yeah.
And then their father,
so
Demaritus, dies.
Yeah.
And the way it plays out is, like, it's like a little bit coincidental, but as it turns out, the grandson, so the son of Arruns, a guy called Durius, isn't born by the time Demaratus dies. Yeah. So Demaratus's will favours the elder son, Lucumo, and makes no provision for the other child, his other son, Arruns, and thus no provision at all for the grandson that he has but didn't know that he was going to have. Goodness knows what happened at family parties when when people turned up pregnant and nobody noticed. In any case, Lucumo ends up with all of the inheritance of his family.
He's accrued a lot of wealth.
He has accrued a lot of wealth. And this means that he is able to parlay a certain extent into the upper echelons of Etruscan society.
Yes, finally, he gets a break.
Yeah, so even though like everybody's kind of suspicious, it's like, oh, but you're rich now? Okay.
That could buy you a certain amount of distinction.
And he marries a noble woman, Tanaquil.
Yes, this is where I was getting to.
And here she is.
Yes.
She's described as a noble woman with expensive taste.
I hear.
She's used to a certain lifestyle.
Yep.
And she wants that lifestyle to continue.
Yep.
Now, she must have liked the guy, I think, because she must have been aware that things were going to be a little bit hazy.
Yeah,
when,
a little bit difficult.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, she's married a rich guy, fine, but he doesn't have the prestige.
Yes.
And she's like, okay, well, that's a problem.
Mm.
And Lucumo's like, well, yeah, I still feel stymied as well. Yeah. And they're both quite ambitious. So they're like...
Fresh start!
Yeah, looking around. And it seems like Tanaquil is really instrumental in making the decision that Rome might be their best opportunity.
Place. Yeah, yeah.
So they're like, oh, all right, so let's leave, get out of the Tarquinii territory, go to Rome. It's a land of opportunity.
Indeed. It's like America.
I was going to say, this feels like it's setting people up nicely for this idea of the American dream.
Yeah, exactly.
But wait.
And as they're about to set out on their journey, I believe there is the all-important sign.
Yes. Well, as they were approaching Rome, they get to Janiculum, which has been annexed and now has the bridge over the Tiber leading to the city.
Sure.
They arrive there, and a prodigy occurs.
What?
Prodigy time.
Yeah, an eagle steals Lucumo's cap and then puts it back on his head.
Yeah, swoops down, gracefully steals his hat, and then swoops back to return it.
Oh, whoops, I thought this was a rabbit. I didn't realize it was your hat.
Yeah.
Please allow me to return it for my apologies. If that isn't a good sign, I don't know what is.
Well, this plays into all of the Roman stereotypes about Etruscans.
Yeah.
Because Etruscans are down with prodigies. And so Tanaquil is held up as like somebody who's good at reading prodigies, knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
And she's like, that is such a favorable sign that things are going to go well in Rome. I kind of even begin to tell you. Yeah. And he's like,
totally made the right move.
Yeah. She's like, this is great. This is an augury that suggests so much success.
And of course the eagle. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Rome is a colon.
It's great. And so they settle in Rome.
Yeah.
And they take on a Roman name.
Yep.
So Lucumo becomes Lucius.
Lucius.
Tarquinius
Priscus.
Mm.
Yes.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. And he sits at work. He's working hard to establish himself, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's got wealth. And as it turns out, that's all you need to have to be able to create influence in Rome at this point in time.
Yeah, the idea of being courteous, inviting people into your home and being quite generous. Setting up relationships.
Yeah.
Establishing yourself as a bit of a patron.
Yes, yeah. This idea of benefaction comes into play.
Yeah, which is very fundamental in Roman society, particularly as time goes on.
Yeah, so this sets up Lucius.
Yeah.
The newly minted
His
Lucius.
Name gets out there, man. And it reaches the ears of a king. Oh, that's right. Ancus.
So Ancus and Lucius meet up, and it turns out that they become great friends.
They do. They're buddy-buddy.
Exactly. This is exciting. I think it's everything that Lucius has ever dreamed of.
Yeah.
He becomes an intimate friend of Ancus.
Yeah.
He also becomes an advisor on matters of warfare and peace and things to do with the state.
Maybe even his personal business. Who the hell knows? But they are getting along.
Yeah, and it gets to the point where Ancus actually makes Lucius the guardian of his children.
Dun, dun, dun!
In his will.
Yeah.
I should say. Yeah. Not just like, I'm just going to give you my children.
Yeah, you know what? I'm kind of sick of raising them. Yeah. Would you mind? You're my buddy. I'm a king.
I've got a couple of boys.
Yeah, and they're just too rowdy.
Really raucous. Yeah. And
so, do you think perhaps we should be wrapping it up here on a bit of a cliffhanger?
Yeah.
Although I think we can probably see where we're going with this. But,
Cliffhanger. All of a sudden. Yeah. So, Ancus is the king of Rome. He's just entrusted in his will his two sons
to this friend of his.
Tarquinius.
New kid on the
block.
Yes.
The new man.
Oh dear. Ooh. What will happen next? I can barely wait to hear. I do hope you will join me next time, Dr. G.
And I
also hope that you have been listening to your history of British kings and queens on the Rex Factor podcast.
Mm.
Check it out, people. I think you'll highly, highly enjoy it.
Good evening, good night, farewell.
And good morning.
So long.